Well, I think most of you know I am interested in all things involving aviation. It's a, you know, it's been a passion of mine since I was a little kid, and I kind of keep track on all the latest developments of airplanes and military aviation also. And the B-2 stealth bomber, I'm sure most of you have heard about that. It is probably the most awesome flying machine that's ever been built. Certainly ranks among the top two or three. For those of you who don't know anything about it, the B-2 is a flying wing, and it's piloted by a crew of two, just two pilots. And there are only 21 exist, and only 21 were ever made, at a cost of over $1 billion each. And they can be loaded with up to 16 tons of smart weapons. And by mid-air refueling, they can bomb any place on Earth so accurately that you can measure the error of the bomb with a yardstick. It is a plane unlike any other. All the B-2s are based in at Whiteman Air Force Base in Missouri, and most of us are familiar with hangars for airplanes, but they developed what they call docks for the B-2. As I said, it's a flying wing, so these docks are about as wide as a football field is long, and the B-2, this wing, can just be backed into the hangar or the dock. The door is closed. And all of the maintenance is done out of sight. The weapons loading is done out of sight, all done behind closed doors, in part because if the enemy sends a satellite over, Russia or China, you can't see what's going on inside that dock, and that's for security reasons. And since the B-2 has no external ordnance, meaning it doesn't hang bombs below the wings or fuel tanks below the wings, as most fighters and fighter bombers and other bombers do, all the ordnance and the fuel is housed inside. When they open the door to the dock and the B-2 taxis out, no one knows whether it's going on a training mission or it's going to fly halfway around the world and bomb the daylights out of somebody. Just don't know. The B-2 began operating in 1995, and its first taste of combat was in Kosovo, Yugoslavia. And its first mission, it took off from Whiteman. It flew a 30-hour round trip from Whiteman all the way to Yugoslavia, unloaded the bombs with pinpoint accuracy, turned around and flew all the way back to Whiteman, never touched ground, 30 hours, 15 hours there, 15 hours back, and accomplished its mission. It was also obviously heavily involved in both Iraq wars, again based out of Whiteman. The B-2 was designed from the beginning to be stealthy, meaning that it is almost undetectable by enemy radar. And for those of you who don't know how radar works, you have a transmitter on the ground in an area that you want to defend, and this transmitter sends radio beams out up into the sky, and then there is a receiving dish right nearby, and those radio waves travel out, and if there's an aircraft up there, you can imagine a commercial airliner or something like that, when those radio waves hit the side of the airliner, they are reflected back to the ground, and this dish picks it up, and it turns out it looks like a blip on a radar screen. And so they can get quite good at almost identifying the type of plane, the altitude, the direction, and all of that. The B-2, however, is designed to be totally stealthy, and the shape of it is designed to reflect the radar waves away from the B-2 and away from the ground so that there is no return. And the skin of the B-2 is designed to absorb radar, and the paint on it, this all-black paint, is designed to absorb radar. The bottom line is the design is so successful that the B-2 has a radar reflection of a tiny bird. So you can imagine being a radar operator and you're trying to find a B-2 around you, and there's a flock of birds go by. Its reflection is no greater than any single bird in a flock of birds. It's almost impossible to detect. However, it's got to fly at night. And the reason is because of its unique shape. This wing, it looks something out of a science fiction movie. And the fact that it's painted all black, during the day it's really easy to see. And I've seen them fly, and you just think that this is something out of science fiction. This aircraft goes over because it looks like it can't even fly almost. And because of its shape and because of its black paint in the day, it can be easily seen. Plus the fact it has no defensive armament at all. It can't defend itself at all. Therefore, it has to fly at night. And when it flies at night, it is almost undetectable. You can't see it. The radar can't see it. And the first evidence that the B-2 is there is bombs raining down and havoc and destruction. Okay, so what does that have to do with the Sabbath? And what does that have to do with us today? Well, there's a scary reality, and that is that we have an invisible being that does exactly the same thing. Stealthy, invisible, don't know this being is around, operates undetected in a cloak of darkness, creates havoc and destruction with no warning at all, and most people in the world, and some even in the church, don't even know this being exists. Don't even know that there is a spirit world out there. And that, as we're going to see, is part of the plan, his plan. So in these last days, I think it's appropriate that we consider this being who is more than ever actively working in the lives of God's chosen people. I got a couple of emails this week saying, I have never seen such anger, opposition, hatred, directed my way, you know, an individual out there and among the scattered brethren. And it just seems like Satan is just stirring things up as never before. So the title of the sermon is Satan the Stealth Being. And we're going to talk about that today because we have an adversary, and if we don't pay attention to that adversary and we don't understand the reality of that adversary, we do so at our own peril. Okay, the first point we want to make is, what is Satan's history and nature? And this will lead up as we go through our time together today of how it relates to us and what we need to be looking out for. What is Satan's history and nature? Okay, let's go to the familiar scripture, Ezekiel chapter 28. We're going to begin in verse 12. I'm going to read this out of the New International Version. It's in some ways more accurate and certainly reads better. Ezekiel 28 and verse 12 out of the NIV. And God is talking initially about the king of Tyre, but we're going to see very quickly that cannot be a human being. Ezekiel 28, verse 12, beginning verse 12, out of the NIV. We're told, Son of man, take up a lament concerning the king of Tyre, and say to him, This is what the sovereign Lord says. Now, God says, You were the model of perfection, full of wisdom, perfect in beauty. So obviously here, when it says the model of perfection, perfect in beauty, and then in the beginning of verse 13, you were in Eden, the garden of God. Now this is obviously not talking about a human being. Going on in verse 13, every precious stone adorned you. Ruby, topaz, emerald, chrysolite, onyx, jasper, sapphire, turquoise, and beryl. Your settings and mountings were made of gold. on the day you were created, they were prepared. So we see here that this being was created by God to be in splendor. And apparently, unlike any other created being at that time, in absolute splendor. Verse 14, you were anointed as a guardian cherub. The King James says, the cherub that covers, alluding to the throne of God. You were anointed a guardian cherub, for so I ordained you. You were on the holy mountain of God. You walked among the fiery stones. So we see here this being was present in front of God's throne. Going on in verse 15, you were blameless in your ways from the day you were created until wickedness was found in you. So we see here there was a time, and we don't know how long that time was, but there was a time when Satan was sinless, and then something happened. Going on in verse 16, this gives us a hint, but not definitively. Beginning of verse 16, through your widespread trade, the NIV says, the Hebrew can mean traffic, it can mean merchandise. So trade, traffic, merchandise, because of that, you were filled with violence. The NIV says the Hebrew can mean injustice by oppression or cruelty. So we see here that by this trade, Satan's nature reflected violence, oppression, and cruelty. And then the last part of the middle part of the verse, and you sinned. Now someday we're going to find out exactly what this means. You know, and when it happened and what actually happened, we don't know. But someday we will. Going on in verse 16, because of this, God says, so I drove you in disgrace from the mount of God. I expelled you, O guardian cherub, from among the fiery stones. Your heart became proud. So there was a time, apparently, when his heart was not proud, but his heart became proud on account of your beauty, and you corrupted your wisdom because of your splendor. And so the blame is on Satan here. It says, you corrupted your wisdom. Nobody else corrupted it for him. He did it. So what happened? Well, he corrupted himself because of pride and because of vanity. Now let's go to the other defining set of scriptures, Isaiah chapter 14, and we'll just read a couple of verses there. We'll begin in verse 12 and read through verse 14 out of the King James, Isaiah 14 and verse 12. Again, this is talking about Satan and what has happened to him. Isaiah 14, verse 12. We're told, how you are fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning. How are you cut down to the ground, which did weaken the nations? Notice what God knows the thoughts of every being, be they spirit being or physical being. He says, for you have said in your heart, in other words, this was a motivation, something Satan thought, I will ascend into heaven, I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit also upon the mount of the congregation. I'm going to sit where God sits. I'm going to elevate myself up to his level. The mount of the congregation and the sides of the north. Now, in verse 14, let me quote from the RSV. It says, I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. I will make myself like the Most High. Like in the Hebrew means comparable to. I'm going to compare myself to God. I'm going to be on his level. So we see here that Satan becomes competitive with God. And this is the first time this has ever happened in the history of created beings, be they human or spirit beings, is that a being began to be competitive with God. He desired to have God's throne, to take God's throne, because, frankly, in his mind, if you put all the scriptures together, he knew better than God. Remember the Garden of Eden when he said to Eve, "Oh, don't believe what God says. You know, God's a liar. Let me tell you the truth." So you see, he was competitive. There came a time when something happened and he became competitive with God Almighty. Now let's go to John 8 and verse 38. And we'll break into the account where Christ is speaking to the scribes and the Pharisees. And they are self-righteous because they think Abraham is their father, and they're putting down Jesus Christ, and of course, Christ straightens them out real quick. John 8, verse 38, Christ is speaking. Christ says, "I speak that which I have seen with my Father." Can you imagine how that rankled them when he said that? "And you do that which you have seen with your father." And they answered and said unto him, "Abraham is our father." And Jesus said unto them, "If you were Abraham's children, you would do the works of Abraham." Verse 40, I'll read out of the NLT. "I told you the truth I heard from God, but you are trying to kill me. Abraham wouldn't do a thing like that." He would not. Going on in verse 41, "You do the deeds of your father." Now let's go back to the King James and jump to verse 44. "You are of your father the devil." Can't be more clear. And he says, "And the lusts of your father you will do." So this tells us that Satan has lusts inside him, and he provokes people to follow up on those lusts. "He was a murderer from the beginning." It's interesting, the Greek word for beginning is a commencement. And so what beginning is that? We don't know. Someday we will find out. "He was a murderer from the commencement," or from the beginning, "and abode not in the truth, because there is no truth in him." Nothing true. "When he speaks a lie, he speaks of his own, for he is a liar and the father of it." So we see here that Satan lusts for what he does not have. He lusts for God's throne. He lusts for God's position, which he did not have. And he will lie and he will murder in order to get what he wants. He turned from the truth, as Christ just said, to the point that he became so perverted, there is no truth in him. Absolutely no truth in him. He doesn't have a remnant of the truth or part of the truth. There is nothing truthful in Satan. So summarizing this first point, Satan is competitive with God. He seeks all for the self, and his perversion is about getting and not giving. That's the first time that happened, is that a being was dedicated to get and not give. The whole plan of salvation, God and Christ working together to work that plan, is about giving and not getting. And Satan turned that around. He wants to exalt himself above God, and he wants to get human beings to worship anything but God. And he, as we're going to see, wants to destroy everything belonging to God, including all of us. He wants us destroyed. Okay, that leads now to the second point we need to make. We need to ask the question, how far-reaching has God allowed Satan's authority to be? Satan can do nothing without God's permission, God's approval. Satan may think otherwise, but that's the reality. So the question is, how far has God allowed Satan to go? Let's go to John 14, and we'll begin in verse 27. We're breaking into Christ's talk with the disciples on the night he was taken, his last discussion with them, John 14, verse 27. He is leaving them, and notice how he ends this up. John 14, verse 27, Christ says, "Peace I leave with you, my peace I give unto you. Not as the world gives, give I unto you. Let not your heart be troubled, neither let it be afraid." And those are words that we should take to heart quite often during these troublous times we live in. Verse 28, "You've heard how I said unto you, I go away and come again unto you. And if you love me, you would rejoice, because I say, I go unto the Father, for my Father is greater than I." And Christ said, that's where I want to be. And you should be happy for me that I'm going. Verse 29, "And now I have told you before it comes to pass, that when it does come to pass, you might believe." Now here we get to the point we need to make today. "Hereafter I will not talk much with you, for the prince of this world comes." The Greek word for prince means chief ruler. So we see here Christ is warning them and saying, after I leave, the one that's going to come is the chief ruler of this world, and he has nothing in me. Remember, he has no truth. And so we see here that he has become so perverted that Satan and Christ have absolutely nothing in common, zero in common. Now, with that in mind, let's go to 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 4. We've seen Satan called the prince or the chief ruler of the world. 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 4 adds to that. Paul is informing us here, I'm reading out of the King James unless otherwise noted, 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 4. Notice this. Paul says, "In whom the God," and that Greek word is theos, "in whom the God," and theos can refer to God or Christ, or in this case, Satan, "in whom the God of this world has blinded the minds of them which believe not, lest the light of the glorious gospel of Christ, who is in the image of God, should shine on them." So we see here, in talking about how far has God allowed Satan to go, how much authority has he allowed Satan to have? Well, God's saying that he is God, that Satan now is God of this world and chief ruler of this world, and it is by God's authority that this is happening. And that's something that we need to understand and pay attention to, because this being, this stealth being, is God of this world. He is the chief ruler of this world. Now let's notice that he has plenty of help. We know that, we won't turn there, but in Revelation 12 and verse 4, we're told that a third of the angels followed Satan when he rebelled against God. So with that in mind, let's go to Revelation 5 and verse 11, and we're breaking into an account where John is beholding God's throne. Revelation 5 and verse 11. And notice what John sees and hears. Revelation 5 and verse 11, John says, "And I beheld, and I heard the voice of many angels," can you imagine, "round about the throne, and the beasts, and the elders. And the number of them was 10,000 times 10,000, and thousands of thousands." Now, if this is a literal number, and I'm not saying it is because we don't know, but if this is a literal number, 10,000 times 10,000 is 100 million. And then if you have thousands of thousands, that's at least two. So you're talking about 102 million angels around God's throne. Now, remember, Satan, when this was written, Satan has already rebelled. So this is the two-thirds of the angels, the total number of angels. These are the loyal, holy, faithful angels. So that means the one-third that have left to go with Satan are 51 million angels as a minimum. Now, if this is not literal, and we don't know, it could be a lot more than 51 million, but at least we can say it is not less than 51 million. And the point is, regardless of which it is, Satan has a lot of help. He has a lot of help to mess around with God's people and to try to come after God's people. So closing the second point, so how great is Satan's authority? He's only the god of this world. Think about that. And when we see what we see on the news today, it is no wonder. On the radio coming down, said there was a shooting, mass shooting in Philadelphia, where this man walked in and said something to the effect that all Jews need to die, and he killed 8 people. The early report said it was even a little baby that was being, I don't know what the ceremony in Judaism is, but killed the little baby and killed 7 other people. That's the early reports. But guess who's behind all of that? Who would provoke somebody to do something like that? That's the god of this world. Now, let's go to the third point. We've seen Satan's authority. We've seen his nature. Now, the third point is we have to ask the question, what is Satan's goal during this age, the age we are here in, that we live in? What is his goal? What is he trying to accomplish? Because if we know what he's trying to accomplish, we can be on guard and we can defend against it. Let's go to 2 Timothy 2 and verse 24. 2 Timothy 2 and verse 24. And I'm going to read this out of the New King James. It is more clear. 2 Timothy 2, verse 24, starting there in the New King James. Now, Paul is talking to Timothy about being an elder, and that's this first phrase. And a servant of the Lord must not quarrel, but be gentle to all, able to teach, and patient. Verse 25. In humility, correcting those who are in opposition, if God perhaps will grant them repentance, so that they may know the truth. Verse 26. That they may come to their senses, notice this, and escape the snare of the devil, having been taken captive by him to do his will. So we see here that there is a snare of the devil. The point is for that snare to take God's people captive in order to do Satan's will. And the Greek word for snare can mean a trap or a trick or a stratagem. Satan's got something in mind. And as we're going to see, it's based on our weaknesses, not our strengths. But his will here is to turn people against God. That's the first thing he did with Adam and Eve, is to turn them against God. No, you can be like God. You don't have to listen to God. You don't have to do what he says. And Satan was successful with Adam and Eve. Now, what is his goal during this age? We find it in a parable of Jesus Christ. Let's go to John chapter 10, the very familiar parable of the sheepfold. John chapter 10, we'll begin in verse 1. And Christ is speaking to the Pharisees, so keep in mind who he's talking to and why he says what he says and the way he says it. John 10, verse 1, Christ speaking to the Pharisees. And Christ says, verily, verily, I say unto you, he that enters not by the door unto the sheepfold, and the Greek for sheepfold means a pen that houses the sheep. He that enters not by the door unto the sheepfold or the pen, but climbs up, that's interesting, he would use this, but climbs up some other way, the same is a thief and a robber. And if you go back, archaeology supports this, and history supports this. Back in when this was written, they didn't have chain link fences and barbed wire. And so how do you make a pen for the sheep? Well, they had plenty of rocks. And what they would do is stack rocks together to form a fence around however large of a sheepfold they wanted or however large of a pen that they needed. And they would stack them in such a way that the sheep couldn't climb up or jump up over. So in effect, it became a pen. And at one end was a door. And there was a doorkeeper. And so we see here, and going on in verse 2, but he that enters in by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. But remember in verse 1, he says, but if somebody climbs up another way, he's a thief and a robber, meaning climbing up over the rocks, not coming in through the door. But he that enters in by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. To him the porter or the gatekeeper opens, and the sheep hear his voice. And he calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. It was quite common for multiple shepherds to house their sheep in a pen at the same time. It wasn't reserved for just one shepherd's sheep. So the shepherds would come and herd their sheep into the sheepfold. And then when that shepherd and those sheep needed to go back out, that is what Christ is talking about right now. And he says, when he says, he that calls his own sheep by name and leads them out, verse 4, and then when he puts forth his own sheep, he goes before them, and the sheep follow him, for they know his voice. A shepherd could walk into the pen and call the sheep by whatever they're used to him calling them and the tone of his voice. They recognize it. He walks out of the sheepfold, and the sheep follow him out. The other sheep don't recognize this voice, and they stay put. So Christ here is obviously talking about himself. He's talking about those whom God has called and turned over to him recognize his voice. Verse 5, and the stranger they will not follow, but will flee from him, for they know not the voice of strangers. And then in verse 6, we're told this parable spoke Jesus unto them, but they didn't understand what things they were which he spoke unto them. They didn't get it. Verse 7, then Jesus said unto him, as he starts to explain, he says, truly, truly, I say unto you, I am the door of the sheep. I'm the door to the sheepfold. Verse 8, all that ever came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not hear them. And he says, those who came prior to me are thieves and robbers. Now, go back to the Garden of Eden. What did Satan promise to Adam and Eve? Oh, you'll be just like God. And so what Satan did is he, in essence, was a thief and a robber of both the truth, and he caused Adam and Eve to make a wrong decision. And in that sense, in one sense, you could say he stole them from God, although this was part of God's plan. We understand that. But this is what Satan says, you can be just like God. And that's exactly what he wanted to be when he rebelled. He wanted to be just like God. He's offering the same thing to Adam and Eve. But Christ says the sheep will not hear them. Verse 9, he says, I am the door. By me, if any man enters in, he shall be saved and shall go in and out and find pasture, find green grass, find water, be taken care of, be fed. Verse 10, the thief comes not but for two, now he talks about three things, to steal and to kill and to destroy. The thief comes to do those three things, kill, steal, destroy. Then Christ says, in contrast to that, I am come that they might have life and they might have it more abundantly. So we see here Satan is the ultimate thief. His goal is to steal the sheep, us, away from God and Christ. by any means necessary. We've already seen that he will lie, he will murder, he will do anything necessary to steal the sheep away from God and Christ. The second thing is he will kill. We just said, he wants to kill us physically. It's only through the grace of God that we're here. Because if Satan had a free reign, we would all be dead. And third, he wants to destroy the sheep, meaning destroy the sheep forever in the lake of fire. And if he can get to us and pervert us and twist us so that we reject God as he rejected God, then we will be in the lake of fire. Steal, kill, destroy. And so my point is this threat is real. We often don't think about it. I mean, we often just kind of go about our daily lives. But the fact is, only through God's intervention are we still alive. Because if God didn't put limits on Satan with us, we wouldn't be here. We'd be dead. So we need to take this threat personally, not just on the church in general or God's people in general, but we need to take it personally in the sense that Satan wants to steal and kill and destroy me personally. Now, as we lead to the next point, let's ask the question, what is Satan's greatest accomplishment thus far? Since Adam and Eve, what is the greatest accomplishment? The thing that he has done thus far, that leads to the next point, the fourth point. Satan has convinced humans that he does not exist. You see, that's the ultimate stealth. At the beginning of the Iraq War, Baghdad was one of the most heavily defended airspaces in the world. Saddam Hussein had spent hundreds of millions of dollars buying the latest state-of-the-art Russian radar and Russian anti-aircraft missiles, and he had put them all around Baghdad and the other cities and the military bases in Iraq. And when the order was given to start the war, the B-2s led the way, starting from Whiteman Air Force Base. They flew all the way to Baghdad. They came right over the top of Baghdad, and nobody knew it. The radar operators are looking at their screens, and there is nothing there. And the next thing they knew, bombs were raining down from heaven, blowing up them, their radar installations, the Air Force bases, and the munitions supply depots, and all of that from this stealth bomber that flew halfway around the world and can put a bomb on a target within a foot and a half circle. Now think about that. And here they thought they were okay. Hey, going to be a quiet night, nothing on the radar screen, let's sip our coffee and put our feet up and not worry about things. And then the first explosion occurred. See, the point is that the stealth bomber is just a toy compared to the stealth being, an intelligent, brilliant being who is stealthy. Let's go to Isaiah chapter 47 and get a hint of what how Satan operates, what his tactics are. And in Isaiah 47, God is talking about the daughter of Babylon. We know who Babylon is, what Babylon is, know how it got started. We know it is a system that is alive today. And the religious ceremonies and the many of the religious beliefs are alive today in this world's religion. So let's go to Isaiah 47 and begin in verse 1. God says, "Come down and sit in the dust, O virgin daughter of Babylon." So this is a daughter of the Babylonian system. "Sit on the ground. There is no throne." God's taken the throne away. "O daughter of the Chaldeans, for you shall no more be called tender and delicate." Okay, so this daughter of Babylon, let's ask the question, who is behind Babylon, the first Babylon? Who is behind the daughter of Babylon? Who is behind the Babylon that exists today? and who is provoking Babylon down through the millennia and today. Who is the being behind it all? Let's go to verse 10. For you have trusted in your wickedness, this daughter of Babylon. You have said, none sees me. Now, isn't that interesting? This gives us a hint of Satan's chief tactic. I can do what I do. I can pursue and teach my perverted religion, and nobody sees me. Nobody is aware of it. This gives us a hint that one of Satan's chief tactics is stealth. We don't know he's there. And you can see over the years, over the millennia, that in little bite-sized chunks, this being behind Babylon has perverted the entire world. Well, Christmas, Easter, New Year's. I mean, the Japanese keep Christmas, for crying out loud. It's all over the world. There was an article in the paper today. Guess what they want to do? They want to change Halloween to Saturday. Now, do you think Satan thinks he's jerking God's chain somehow? They want to do it on a Saturday night because it's such a strain to lead our kids out in the middle of the week, and they've got to go to school the next morning. I've got to work the next morning, and it's just such a hassle. And so let's make it Saturday night so we can follow Satan with a freer hand. That's how perverted. It'll pass. You just watch. It's going to happen. And Satan does it so stealthily, little bite-sized chunks, until he's got us. Going on in verse 10. Your wisdom and your knowledge, it has perverted you. The King James margin says, led you astray. This is true for the daughter of Babylon, but it's equally true for the being behind the daughter of Babylon. And you have said in your heart, I am, and there is none beside me. That's exactly what Satan said when he tried to take over God's throne. I am the end-all and be-all. I am above God. There is none like me, and I'm going to take over this throne. You see, it's the same attitude as the being that is behind Babylon. Now, if that wasn't enough, let's go back to chapter 29, Isaiah 29, and just read one verse, verse 15. We're establishing the principle that one of Satan's tactics is to do things stealthily in such a way that people don't think he even exists. Therefore, they can't defend themselves. Isaiah 29 and verse 15. Woe unto them that seek deep to hide their counsel from the Lord. And I've met people in the church that thought that they could sin and God wouldn't know it. Now, can you imagine that? But they've convinced themselves that they could sin and somehow God would wink at it, or he wouldn't see it, or he wouldn't acknowledge it. And that's exactly what's happening here. Woe unto them that seek deep to hide their counsel from the Lord. And their works are in the dark, and they say, who sees us? Who knows us? You see, this is exactly what Satan is doing. And the key to Satan's stealthiness is that he deceives humanity into believing there is not a spirit world at all. If you can't measure it, if you can't see it, if you can't smell it, if you can't taste it, if you can't touch it, it does not exist. That's what our kids are taught in school. That's what our young people are taught in colleges and universities of higher learning. There is no spirit world. Satan has deceived the entire world into thinking he doesn't exist. Now, let's notice the power of this stealth being. Let's go to the familiar scripture, Revelation 12 and verse 9. This describes something that has yet to happen, we believe. I think probably when it does happen, some dramatic things would occur on earth. But as soon as I think I have it figured out, it doesn't work out that way. So I'm not going to take any kind of stand on this one. Revelation 12 and verse 9. a time yet future probably, that the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, so there's no doubt about who this is referring to, which deceives the whole world. Now, it's interesting, the Greek word for whole means complete every whit. Now, think about that. It doesn't leave any room for, this word doesn't leave any room for an exception. Complete every whit, every tiny little bit, deceives the whole world. And we underestimate this stealth being at our own peril if we don't realize that. The entire world, not just part of it, the world. Now, with that in mind, let's go to 2 Corinthians 11 and verse 14 and see how this deception occurs. How he can deceive us into thinking that he's not a threat, he doesn't exist, the world, or among God's people, that he's not a threat, that we don't have to worry about him. 2 Corinthians 11 and verse 14. Paul says, "And no marvel, for Satan himself is transformed into an angel of light." Now, the key is the King James margin. If you have a King James, it says, "Satan transforms himself into an angel of light." In other words, some outside force doesn't transform Satan into an angel of light. Satan himself changes himself so that he gives the appearance of an angel of light. Verse 15, "Because of this, because he can transform himself into an angel of light, therefore it's no great thing if his ministers also be transformed as the ministers of righteousness, wolves in sheep's clothing, whose end shall be according to their works." Now, how does he do this? Verse 3 tells us, "But I fear lest by any means, as the serpent beguiled Eve through his subtlety, so your minds," in a like manner, "so your minds should be corrupted from the simplicity that is in Christ." The Greek word for subtlety is Strong's 38:34. And it means, I'm quoting Strong's, "in a bad sense, trickery, cunning, craftiness." In a bad sense, trickery or cunning craftiness. We would say today, stealth. Because through trickery, through cunning craftiness, the world doesn't believe Satan exists, or even God's people don't believe he is a threat every day to our lives, to our minds, to our emotions. And that is his great accomplishment. He's not real to the world, and on a daily basis, he's not real to too many brethren either. And often they allow themselves to get, and we've all done it, I'm speaking to myself too, we allow ourselves to have moods and attitudes and spirits that are just not right, and we just kind of go with the flow, not stopping and thinking, well, where did that come from? Who's behind that? You see, too often we think the enemy is other people. The enemy is our boss, or the enemy is our neighbors, or the enemy is the government, or the enemy is this person who doesn't like me very much. The real question is, who is behind those who oppose us? What's the spirit behind them? It's easy when somebody comes after us to focus on the person coming after us rather than stop and take a deep breath and say, okay, who's provoking them to come after us? What is the spirit behind them and what they're doing? Let's go to Ephesians 6 and verse 12. This is something, when we face opposition, this is something that we need to continually be mindful of. Ephesians 6, verse 12. I'm going to read this out of the NIV. This we need to keep in the forefront of our minds. Ephesians 6 and verse 12. Out of the NIV. "For our struggle is not against flesh and blood." So let's just stop there and say, okay, Can I accept that? Can I realize that? That when we have physical opposition from physical human beings, that is not the real struggle. The real struggle is what is behind them, what is motivating them or provoking them. Going on, not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in heavenly realms. Since Satan is the god of this world, and he has in excess of 50 million helpers, and the world is the way it is, as we see daily, I mean, there's a shooting or a raping or somebody being taken captive in this, the most civilized country in the world, apparently, is supposed to be. If this is happening here, guess what's happening all around the world? You see, who is behind all of that? Spiritual forces of evil in heavenly realms. The point is that Satan is our real adversary, and he is the one who provokes humans into doing what they do. And we often are the recipients, but we forget that, and you know, it's just human nature. You react to what's being told you or yelled at you or screamed at you or written to you. We react to that, but we don't stop and think, okay, what provoked them to do this? We need to keep that in mind. You see, we need to be on guard against our real enemy. Let's go to 1 Peter 5 and verse 8. Very familiar scripture, but we need to remember this on a daily basis. I'm going to read this out of the NIV. It's an interesting translation of 1 Peter 5 and verse 8. 1 Peter 5 verse 8 out of the NIV. Peter is saying to us today, 1 Peter 5, verse 8, he says, be self-controlled and alert. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. Okay, he's looking for someone, but Peter says, if we're self-controlled and alert, we don't have to be that one. It can be, you know, he'll go after somebody else, because if we're alert and we're controlling ourselves, meaning we're not sinning, then we're not easy pickings. Satan will go after somebody else. Let's go to Revelation 12 and verse 10. Revelation 12 and verse 10, we were there earlier. But this gives us a hint of what Satan does and who our real enemy is. Revelation 12, verse 10. John says, I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now is come salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ. For the accuser of our brethren is cast down. This is after this occurs, so don't think it's happened yet, but it's going to happen. But the point is, Satan doesn't change. This accuser, which accused them before our God day and night. So this tells us, before Satan was cast down, guess what? Satan is accusing God's people before him, before God the Father, day and night. And, you know, we can go back and read the account of Job, where Satan was walking up and down in front of God's throne, and God knows what he's doing. He says, have you considered my friend Job? And that started a conversation, and so Job was accused by Satan, saying, look, you let me touch him, and he's going to curse you to your face. Accuse, accuse, accuse. So we see here that Satan accuses us before God day and night. Verse 11, here's the good news. And they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. The Greek word for testimony means record. They overcame Satan by their record, by what they actually did. And we're all establishing a record in our lives that is as we would say, written in stone, and we're going to have to answer for that record. But we're told here that those who overcome Satan do so by their record, what they actually do and what they think and what's in their mind, and they loved not their lives unto the death. That's how far it can go. You see, Satan's stealthiness is a threat to each one of us, and the reason it's a threat is because he can convince us that it's not a personal threat. It's a threat to the church, yes. You know, it's a threat to some people can say, well, the work of God, or, you know, the truth of God or whatever, but we don't often apply it to ourselves and by saying, he is out to get me, steal, kill, destroy me. And he does so by keeping us so busy with day-to-day stuff with the world that we're not aware of his influence. Not aware of the emotions that he can plant in our head. Not aware of the attitudes and the thoughts he can put in our minds. But, you see, Paul tells us we can know Satan's plan. Let's go to 2 Corinthians 2. We'll begin in verse 10. We can know his plan, and that helps us defend against his efforts at destroying us. 2 Corinthians 2, verse 10. Read this out of the NIV. A little more clear. 2 Corinthians 2 and verse 10 out of the NIV. Paul says, if you forgive anyone, I also forgive him. And what I have forgiven, if there was anything to forgive, I have forgiven in the sight of Christ for your sake. Okay, 2 Corinthians 2, now verse 11 is the key. One of the things we have to do is forgive and not let a root of bitterness come, because that is a way Satan can get to us. And Paul's saying, need to forgive. Verse 11, in order that Satan might not outwit us, for we are not unaware of his schemes. The New International says, the King James, the New King James say devices. Thayer says evil purposes. So we see here, Paul says, we can know them, we can be aware of them, and that will help us fight our adversary. That leads us to the final point, point number five. What are Satan's stealthy schemes? What are Satan's stealthy schemes? His overall objective is to get us to sin. We won't turn there, but remember Isaiah 59, the first two verses, we're told that sin separates us from God. So he is brilliant. If he can get us to sin, then that separates us from God. Then we are more easy to attack because we're not as close to God as we were before we started sinning. So we have to keep in mind that his goal is to get us to sin. Now, back to the B-2 for a minute. When the B-2 launches, they have a computer disk in this massive computer that's in this airplane. It couldn't fly without the computer. It's aerodynamically unstable. And the computer keeps it flying, literally. But part of that computer system is a disk that has all the targeting instructions for that particular mission. And through intelligence, on-the-ground intelligence, satellite intelligence, and all of that, they know where the radar stations are, the antennas, and the broadcast stations for the radar, they know where they are located in the enemy's territory. And I've seen some of these maps, and you can see it's kind of a bird's eye view. You're looking down, and you see the mountains and the terrain and all that, and over here it's a symbol. Over here is a radar station. Over here is a radar station. Over here is a radar station. And so rather than just ignore the strengths of the enemy, what the computer does is fly a profile in between these radar stations. And the B-2 has a stronger return in some radar return in some angles than others. And so if they can keep the attitude of the B-2 relative to the transmitter and receiver to where the B-2 has the lowest possible return, then that maximizes their chance of being successful. So the B-2 navigates and at the right bank angle, at the right altitude, at the right profile of the plane relative to the radar, it maximizes its a chance of success. And it exploits the weakness of the enemy, where their radar might be weak or where their area of coverage might be not as good. And so this is all programmed into the computer, and before it takes off, this flight plan is set to maximize their chance of success and to avoid the strengths of the enemy and attack the weaknesses of the enemy. Satan does exactly the same thing. He is warped, he is perverted, but he is brilliant. And he identifies our weak points, and he attacks our weak points. He doesn't attack where we are strong. He attacks where we're weak because he knows that that is where he is most likely to succeed in getting us to sin. He influences our thoughts, our moods, our attitudes. Let's go to Ephesians 2 and verse 2. Ephesians 2 and verse 2. Satan can do things that humans can't, and he does so stealthily, and if we're not aware of it, we are putting ourselves in jeopardy. Ephesians 2 and verse 2. Paul says, "Where in times past you walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince," same Greek word, chief ruler, "according to the chief ruler of the power of the air, the spirit that now works in the children of disobedience." Now, this is talking about the chief ruler of the air. Now, what on earth does Paul mean by that? I can remember Dorothy's mom lived to be 102 years old, and we were visiting once, and she was describing what it was like to hear the first radio. And when you think about it, you know, if you've never heard a radio before, you know, this is something magical and marvelous in your view. So a neighbor bought the first radio in the area, and she says we went over. They invited us over one night to go listen. And so we saw this box. Back in those days, radios were big boxes, waist-high boxes, about like this. And had a lot of components in there, and she saw the plug in the wall, but that was it. And they turned the radio on, tuned the dial, and all of a sudden a voice came out of this box. Now, if that had never happened to you before, what would the reaction would be? It would be like, wait a minute. You know, you walk around it, you look, there's nobody inside the box, and all of a sudden you hear a voice out of this box. That, where did that come from? Well, there's a transmitter, you know, miles away, and it's coming through the air. Well, but I don't see that. You see, that's kind of the marvel of modern communication, but the point is that Satan works the same way. And I think this analogy of the air, the power of the air, draws a direct analogy for us today. Maybe not 1,000 years ago, but it does today. Paul knew that. Verse 3. "Among whom also we all had our conduct in times past, in this prince of the power of the air, the lusts of our flesh, fulfilling the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature the children of wrath, even as others." And so we put all this together, much like a radio transmitter transmits to a radio receiver in somebody's home, and out comes a voice. The same thing can happen to us. All of a sudden, everything's fine, and all of a sudden we feel kind of angry, or we feel ticked off, or we feel a little knot in the stomach of fear or something, anxiety. And it came from nowhere. 2 minutes ago, we were fine. Now we're not. And if we're not aware of what Satan is doing, we just kind of never think of the source of it, and we just start dealing with, well, I'm angry, so then you kick the cat or yell at somebody or, you know, do something like that, rather than stop and say, well, wait a minute. 2 minutes ago, I wasn't angry. 2 minutes ago, I was at peace. So what happened? Well, if we have our mind on our adversary, our accuser, then maybe we could stop and say, okay, now that thought is not a godly thought. That emotion is not a godly emotion. So guess who's behind that? Who broadcast that into my mind? So we stop and we say a prayer and we ask God to rebuke the thought and to shield us from those broadcasts. And then we go on with our life. But why thoughts and moods and attitudes? Why does Satan do that rather than some other way? Let's go to James 1 and verse 13. James 1 and verse 13. There's a principle here that we're getting to. James 1 and verse 13. James says, let no man say when he's tempted, I'm tempted of God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, neither tempts he any man. But, here's the key, every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust. Now, where is that? It comes in the mind. Starts in the mind. His own lust and enticed. Then, when lust has conceived, meaning the mind carries that lust further into the mind sinning or the body sinning, it brings forth sin, and sin, when it is finished, brings forth death. The principle here is sin begins in the mind. That's where it starts. And if Satan can provoke us to sin in our minds, he has us. And we have to be aware of that, be aware that there's an adversary broadcasting those thoughts and emotions, and we need to stop it. Let's go to 1 John 2 and verse 16. 1 John 2 and verse 16. This, we need to remember who is behind this world. 1 John 2 and verse 16. The Apostle John says, for all, the Greek word for all is means the whole, the entirety. For the entirety that is in, all that's in the world, everything that's in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. And who is the God of the world? We've already talked about that. It's this being. And that is why we have to have a new mind. And we won't turn there, but in Ephesians 4, Colossians chapter 3, we're taught that we have to put away the old man or the old woman and put on the new man or the new woman. And this new man or new woman is made after the image of God in Christ. And we are told, you can use it as a reference, Ephesians 4 and verse 27, if we don't do that, we give Satan a foothold. Meaning, if he broadcasts an emotion or a thought and we don't deal with it and reject it, now he's got a foothold. Then what happens is we commit a sin. We might yell at somebody. We might say something we later regret. We might go do something that we later regret. That gives Satan a foothold. So, ending this fifth point, Satan's strategy is to get us to sin and separating us from God and Christ, our shepherds, John 10, verse 10, so that he can kill us, he can destroy us, he can steal us. Okay, let's summarize now. There's nothing new here today. You know, it's we all know this, but I have to be reminded of it. I have to remind myself that there is a force working against me and against all of us, and we need to recognize this force. This is the force working against us is the second most powerful force in the universe. I think sometimes we don't realize that. The second most powerful voice or force in the universe. And that force is trying to separate us from God. But the good news is we have access to the most powerful force in the universe that is greater than the force of our accuser or our adversary. Let's go to James 4 and verse 6. And let's read what James has to say about this, because this is the key. When we are tempted, tested, have thoughts, emotions that we shouldn't be having, this is a good verse to read, or series of verses, James 4, verse 6. James says, "But he gives more grace. Wherefore he says, God resists the proud," that's Satan, of course, pride, "but gives grace to the humble." Christ was humble. Verse 7, here's what we need to do. Submit. Submit yourselves, therefore, to God. First thing to do. Second, resist the devil. Don't accept it. Don't act on it. Stop and reject it. And he will flee from you. That is a promise. If we resist, we are given a promise that he will flee, because God is more powerful than Satan. Verse 8, draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. That is another promise. So we submit, we resist, we draw near. And now our job, the last sentence, cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. We need to ask God for his protection. That's why, you know, the model prayer in Matthew chapter 6, you know, our daily prayer, we're told to pray that God would deliver us from the evil one, as it should be. Not just from evil, but from the evil one. And remember in Jude chapter 9, the archangel Michael was fighting with Satan over the body of Moses. And Michael said, "The Lord rebuke you," because Michael was not more powerful than Satan, but he knew God was, and so he called on the power of God. And so similarly, when we get in a jam like that, we have to call on the power of God to rebuke these thoughts, these emotions, these attacks from Satan. Let's go to one final scripture in Psalm 91, and we'll begin in verse 1. The Psalms are so encouraging, and this is a psalm we can go to when the adversary, the accuser, is attacking us, and there are so many promises here. We'll close with this scripture, Psalm 91, verse 1. "He that dwells in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty." Most High and Almighty. In the God's presence. Verse 2, "I will say of the Lord, he is my refuge and my fortress, my God, in him will I trust." Not myself, not other human beings, but in God. "Surely he shall deliver you from the snare of the fowler and from the noisome pestilence. He shall cover you with his feathers, and under his wings shall you trust." Drawing an analogy of a protective mother or father bird. "His truth shall be your shield and buckler," knowing the truth. Jumping to verse 11. "For he shall give his angels charge over you to keep you in all your ways." That is a promise. "They shall bear you up in their hands, lest you dash your foot against a stone. And you shall tread upon the lion and the adder, the young lion and the dragon you shall trample under feet." Now in verse 14, God speaks. "Because he has set his love upon me," God says, Therefore will I deliver him. That is a promise. Love God with all our heart, with all our being. If we love God with all our heart, first commandment, I will set him on high. Why? Because he has known my name. That individual knows who God is and trusts God. Have to know who he is first in order to trust God. And so this is a promise that if we just understand who God is, that he is the most powerful force in the universe, and Satan must do his will, when we get in a jam like this and are under attack, read Psalm 91 and verse 1 and claim the promises that God will provide and take care of us, and he will set us on high. So let's always have the reality of Satan in the forefront of our minds. Let's always be aware of his presence, but the fact is that he is stealthy. And always be aware of his evil intentions toward us so that we can avoid giving him a foothold in our lives. And so we will not allow him to affect our lives, and we will draw closer to God, and we will resist Satan and overcome him through the power of God and Jesus Christ.